This is a special edition of Commodity Week, the trendline yield for corn.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. We want to talk about trendline yield today. We're going to just talk about corn. USDA is using 181.5. At this point, we won't see the official yield for the new crop until we get to the May WASDE World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate. That's due out on the 12th. However, a couple of weeks ago at the NASS Data Users Group meeting, Dale Durkles and Jerry Goodell were both there. Dale's with Grain Cycles, Jerry's with Midland Research. And they had a discussion with the folks at USDA NASS about this 181.5. And whether that number is correct, why they use that number, and we decided it might be worth talking about just a little bit. So invited the two of them, along with Bob Nielsen, who is a professor emeritus from Purdue University, agronomist, the corn guy there. Thank you, Bob, for agreeing to do this, by the way. And he had written an article in February about trendline, going back all the way to, 1956, I think, Bob. Can you lay out, and I know you don't use the USDA calculations, but can you lay out what your trend line tells you about trend yield in the United States over that time?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, I just sort of have an interest in historical yields and what's happened with corn over the decades. So I play with this a lot, just using Excel, and so as I've done that, I've really ended up with three different yield improvement lines, going all the way back to the mid 1800s, and with that you can document the impact of hybrid corn in the 1930s, and then which obviously had a major impact on yield improvement, But then in the mid-1950s, there was another change in that slope of that trend line as other technologies were adopted. And so I've played with this off and on for many years. And so the trend line that I use for myself as I look at, trying to predict at least the ballpark yields for the coming year is one that begins in 1956 and goes all the way through current years. And so that trend line describes the variability in yield over the years very well, and it would predict for this current year a possible national yield of 179.3. As I tried to get across in that article I wrote a couple months ago was. These trend lines are very much dependent on how much data are sitting behind them, and so so if you use really short-term periods, sometimes you can be led astray. And I used a couple of examples in that article of one beginning in a 10-year period beginning, I think, in 1964. Which if you use just that 10-year period, it was a very good 10-year period, and it had a yield gain on average of about 2.9 bushels per acre per year increase over that 10-year period. If you believed the trend line and if you believed it was accurate and extend that all the way to 2023, it would be predicting a national yield average of 237 bushel. Well, I think we all agree that that's a bit unrealistic, and yet if you look at another 10-year period beginning in the mid 1990s when all of the transgenic corn hybrids began to come on the market and everybody got excited about transgenes and GMOs and what that was going to do to yield, and if you took the 10-year period beginning in 1996 and graph that out, it was a trend line of about 2.7 bushel per acre per year, and so it looks pretty good. And in fact, if you would extend that out to 2023, it would be predicting an average yield of 200 bushel. Well, again, I think we all agree that 200 is a bit out of line too. So I just I guess personally, I feel comfortable with the trend line that frankly goes back 67 years. It describes the historical yields very well. It is interesting if you begin in 1996 and calculate it through last year, you actually end up with a very similar equation. And so if you're not comfortable with 67 years of data, because you think that's just too old and too far back, we might be able to begin with 1996 because it gives us pretty much the same message that the longer term data does. So, and I guess the other thing I'd say is I was intrigued by the discussion that I simply read the minutes of from the USDA user meeting. And I was intrigued only from the standpoint that I was reminded that being a simple agronomist, I sort of forget about the global impact of these yield predictions and how important it is to try and get those predictions accurate. So I just found that interesting for myself because as an agronomist, I'm mostly worried about agronomic issues, in the immediate future. So that's sort of the background on that, Todd.
Just one note, you use 1996. I'm going to make a guess. That's because that's when the BT technology, it would have been for European corn borer at that time, was introduced and began to be widely accepted, or for some other reason?
No, pretty much exactly that. And what I do find interesting is that if you use the trend line beginning with the introduction of GMOs, the trend line, the equation is essentially identical to the trend line that begins in 1956, and which tells me, again, the simple agronomist that I am, it tells me that the transgenic hybrids have had essentially no effect on the rate of annual yield improvement of corn in this country. And so it has not been the, God's gift to corn like it was made out to be by some of the industry back in the 90s.
And that trend line is 1.9 bushels to the acre each year?
Rounded up 1.9, yes.
So Jerry and Dale, and maybe Jerry, I'll start with you. When you had the discussions with the folks from USDA in Kansas City, what were the points you were hoping to make with them?
Given the recent activity here and that the difference of utilizing what I assume, and I wrap it in a adjusted yield, is that basically when you go back to try to reproduce it in the time period of 1990 to now, you basically drop out 2012. And 2012 is an aberration, there's no doubt about it. But in reality, it's also part of the long-term numbers that Bob's talking about here, and how that it's a part of the history of corn yields. And so the interesting thing about it is, if you keep that in and then put that through the numbers, you've got a number that comes in on a regression analysis of 179, maybe 178.5, depends on how you look at it. But that's a scenario of virtually two bushels. Now, I understand that's not a big number, but when you talk about establishing that as the middle of what your possibilities are, and then turn around and put a range on each side of it, that's a huge difference now as to what the market perceives as their potential crop size. And that was the thing that I thought, and even Dale, both of us think that they needed to either include 2012 or potentially, in my case, and even Dale talked about it, is looking at shortening this number up and look at it from maybe 2000 or maybe from Bob's level there at 170 or 1996 to look at that trend that way, because the fact that if you look at those numbers, right now, USDA's put their 181.5 out here. Now, all of a sudden, we're talking about carryover stocks over 2 billion, this kind of stuff. And so that adds to our investing community that don't really understand the agronomics of what goes on. And at this point, the possibility of corn yields jumping from 173. And let's just say the 181.5 is exactly right. Let's put us at 3 bushel higher number on the top side and 3 bushels below it. Bang, zoom. We're talking 184. I don't think there's a possibility of a 184 yield logically coming after a 173. Now, I'll guarantee you the people that were down in Omaha for that particular Dave Eustace meeting, half the crowd was probably saying, oh, it's just time for that. We're supposed to have a big jump. Mm-hmm. The other side is saying, well, let's don't talk about projecting it until we get there. And I think that's the one thing that I was really kind of trying to point to the USDA and the people in that room was that, yes, we're going to have higher yields, but the probability of putting into the investing community, which don't really have any idea how much corn capability there is, that, oh, well, we can have a 183, 84, very logical. Let's put it right in there. Boy, that's guaranteed. And I think that's really reflected a little bit in what's happened in the last 2 or 3 weeks in the marketplace. Not so much because they understood 184 or 181 or 178, but the reality that there was going to be more than enough and it was guaranteed. I think that's the frustration part of our investing community that don't really understand how these things really work and the probability. Each year, yields are on 1 year probability. They're not on, oh, by the way, this is the year that's going to go up 10 bushels. That seems like that isn't the way statistics work, is it, Bob?
Well, you make a very good point that this notion that it's about time for corn to take a jump, that would only be true if there was some miraculous new technology that had suddenly come on the market. Otherwise, we stick with the trend lines, which says, yes, we're due for a little bit more yield, you know, roughly 2 bushels per acre based on the trend line. But again, if you use, you know, either one of these two that I've talked about that give you the same regressions, or even yours that you've used, we're all sort of saying 179 is a more realistic number, which from a trend line perspective is about 2 bushel better than last year's trend line prediction. So yes, we're due for an increase in yield, but it'll be a couple bushel, not 10 based on the trend line. Now, having said that, we all know that weather plays a tremendous impact on yield. So if weather would be absolutely perfect throughout the entire Midwest, we could see a 10 bushel jump. But that's not likely to happen, and so I think it's more realistic, as you say, to, you know, let's stick with trend line predictions that are a little more realistic. And I would agree. After 2012, I struggled myself with whether I should keep it in the equation, and I went back and forth for quite some time trying to justify to myself, you know, should we drop it or should we not, and I just finally made the decision, similar to what you indicated earlier, that, hey, that is life. It happens, and we could have a terrible year even this year, and it would drop again. And so I've left it in my trend lines that I work with.
Todd, this is Dale. It's really kind of interesting listening to the discussion so far. There are a couple of things that really jump out at me. First off, Professor Nielsen mentioned his trend that starts back in 1956, and he had sent us each an email here earlier today. And one thing on that not a lot of people really pay much attention to, but it had an R square, which really tends to tell you about the quality of the regression that you're using. It had an R square of 0.94. I remember when I was in grad school taking a stats course, and the professor teaching it, the math professor, was so adamant. He said, if you run a regression and you don't get something with a 95% R-square, start questioning it, certainly if it's below 90. And one thing I've noticed that just in general, since a lot of people have gotten comfortable now that we have Excel and we have all this statistical stuff available to us, there are a lot of people with regressions in particular that I say, play fast and loose. Mm-hmm. They'll come up with a regression for example, on a Trenia like this, let's say it's got an R-square, let's say 0.65 or 0.70. And you know, they use it and they tout how good a regression it is. It really isn't. So I point back to the quality of those regressions that people are using. It's important to people to understand that and what they mean. And, you know, his 0.94 R-square really jumped out at me and said, you know, it's a really good number to really be working with on a long term. Mm-hmm. The other two things I note in here, Jerry touched on one of those, was just the impact, you know, some of these early USDA estimates are having on the managed money crowd. And it is really real. If we have a situation like Jerry tends to believe this year that, you know, maybe our trend is a little bit too aggressive. And Paul Westcott and Michael Jewison, you know, did a lot of study on this weather adjusted trend that they used that gave us the 181.5. You know, but we got to be careful. We got to be sensitive out there, I think, anymore in the statistical realm of the impact this has on the trading community and in the managed money crowd or the hedge fund crowd in particular, because a lot of people take some of this data and they view it as really being very quality data, which in most cases it is, but it can have bias. And that brings me, and you know, like right now, and Jerry's argument, maybe the trend's a little aggressive. And even Professor Nielsen said around 179, you know, that would say they're aggressive as well. Well, that has a negative bias in terms of price structure at the early part of the season. Mm-hmm. And we need to be careful to try to keep that bias balanced. The other thing I come along with here and looking at the way I look at corn trends, Jerry was looking at them, Professor Nielsen highlighted too that he's looked at among a myriad of others. And a lot of this is really art. It is not necessarily science. It is art and trying to find what works, what fits, and trying to justify it. Scott Irwin, it was, I think, a year ago, could have been 2 years ago, came up with a multiple regression as far as U.S. soybean yields were concerned. And it had a really good R-square, as I remember. I want to say something up to about 0.9 or something like that. And when you looked at the experience and the actual yield numbers, an extremely good fit. But it was parabolic that said, you know, we have bean yields that are going into the stratosphere right away. So, mm-hmm. you know, you got to start to understand, you know, the art of doing all of this. And I think Professor Nielsen and his looking at a number of different time parameters, you know, is saying that, you know, we've it's really kind of an art. And that really makes it difficult for everybody.
Scott Irwin and Joe Jansen, by the way, used 180 for this coming year. Bob, you wanted to go on?
Well, I was going to add to that, you know, that's a really good point. And it's the art comes from the fact that corn is influenced by a bazillion factors other than the increase of calendar time. And so just because the trend line says we should increase that national yield by 1.9 bushels per acre this year, there's so many things that influence yield. And I know that the markets say that they understand that, but I sometimes question whether they really do, because, you know, when I say that, you know, we've got a national yield of 179, you know, for 2023, that's my starting point, because I know that, you know, after, you know, the first thing on the horizon is getting this crop planted. Well, that's going to have an impact on that 179. And then, you know, getting it out to pollination time and what can go good and wrong with pollination, that also is going to tweak that number. And, you know, as we get into later part of the season, where we often get a lot of, or the risk of disease development increases, and, you know, that's going to add its 2 cents worth to it. So, you know, this is simply a starting point when we use these trend lines. And I'm just not sure people fully realize that that number can go up and down so easily. But again, that's my 2 cents worth, I guess, on that. It just sort of reinforcing what Dale was saying.
What did USDA tell you, the two of you, at the data users group meeting about what their calculations look like, and why they use them? And did they talk about having calculations made the same way year in and year out for decades or years, and what difference that makes? I'm guessing at what kinds of things they may have told you. I don't know, Jerry. What did they give you as answers to those questions?
Well, they didn't give away their formula by any means. They published their formula, and they talk about it in generalities and things like that. And they talk about what would be normal on plannings and things of this nature. I think the one couple things, though, that interestingly enough, they didn't challenge the idea that this yield could be lower than the 181.5 blatantly in the room, but they didn't really support their 181.5 number very, vehemently, that type of thing. The one thing that I think that, as I kind of pointed out in some of my communications today, yields are a combination of some of the great technologies and ideas that have happened over the last 25 years. We have got GMO corn. We have taken our spacings down in our fields. Yes, we've got better weed control, things like that. But at the same time, we've also, and this is brought up when I'm in a discussion with a friend of mine, is that we have moved the corn fields in the U.S. from the eastern Nebraska and irrigation a lot further west and south into lands that are not strong like they are in Illinois and Indiana and Iowa. There's no 200 bushel corn in western Kansas, South Dakota, North Dakota. Those are factors in this calculation that we are moving these acres into places that don't have that capability. And also, how much more? We were at a record yield in Illinois last year, and yet we were 173 nationwide. So is Illinois going to go to another 10 bushels up this year, along with maybe rebound to North Dakota to get ourselves a big jump? I don't know about that.
I will remind you, Jerry, that we were record yields in Illinois, and I believe that number was, 214? Is that correct, Dale? I think that's right.
Yeah.
But we had a drought targeted right here in East Central Illinois for a lot of the year, and there was much discussion that this crop wasn't going to get be nearly as good as it could be. 214 was out of the ballpark. I have talked to USDA enough times to know that they probably are using that 181.5 for historical factors. I'm interested to know, Bob, what you think about the outside influences going further west, further south, those kinds of things, and what impact that has. I also know that from USDA's perspective, once they get to this May WASDE, this would be the World Ag Outlook Board and not USDA NAS. Those first numbers don't come out until the month of August with the crop production figures, that they will use some arts and crafts, I guess, is what I'll call it, to suggest we've had a crop in the ground. It is very early. It's been cold. Emergence, whatever number they're using at that time, suggest to us that either this is better than average, on average, or below average, and they may very well adjust the 181.5 in the May WASDE. Then again, they may not. They will use the prospective plantings report from USDA because that's the number we have until we get to June 30th. Now, back to you, Bob. When we add those acres that are outside of the Corn Belt in, does it make very much of a difference?
It's a really good point that I hadn't thought much about before, but it is true that the decades of yields that we all three of us work with on doing these trend lines has tended to come from the traditional Corn Belt of the country. And yes, we've expanded, especially up in the Dakotas. We've expanded into Kansas with more acreage, and those three states in particular. And of course, South Dakota is what, almost the fifth largest in the country now in terms of acreage, I think. We're, you know, neck and neck with Indiana.
In terms of production, it
yeah.
is.
But, and so if that increase in acreage gets large enough, then yes, it might begin to influence the accuracy of the trend line. And but I still think, because the vast bulk of the production is coming still from the traditional Midwest Corn Belt, that influence will probably be fairly minimal. But I'm just sort of off the top of my head talking now, without having, you know, really looked at what's behind it very much. The other comment I would make, Todd, with what you said on whether the USDA will tweak it before the August report, you know, one of the comments I made to the three of you in emails earlier today was that what I have looked at using simply relationship with crop condition ratings throughout the season in an attempt to tweak those numbers that I work with. And what I found is that the June crop condition ratings has a very poor relationship to eventual yield. And so that it's not very accurate to be using June crop condition ratings. But once you get out into July and August and look at regression relationships between those condition ratings and eventual yield, it improves quite a bit. And you can get R squares up, you know, around, you know, 0.7 to maybe 0.78, those kind of numbers, you know, reasonably good. It's still not perfect, and there's still a lot of fluff on either side of that kind of regression also. But really, until you get to July, you can play around with using crop condition to adjust those predictions, but it's not terribly accurate until you have, say, July and August together, and then eventually July, August, and September, and then it begins to do well. So, but again, as I think I also mentioned in the email earlier today, I don't know what USDA uses either, but I'm sure at least down the road there's going to be some artificial intelligence opportunities to tweak, to make these tweaks down the road. And that's certainly beyond, you know, anything that I have experience in. But I can certainly imagine that AI will probably have a place down the road for fine-tuning these early season predictions.
A couple of points, Todd. This kind of fill-in information for the guys or anyone that listens. First off, if you go to USDA ERS and do a search under publications, in particular, search for Paul Westcott, because Paul Westcott and Michael Jewison developed this weather-adjusted trend model they use. There's a whole paper at ERS on this particular model telling you how it's constructed. So that's in there. One thing that that Jerry brought up, and to kind of fill in for Professor Nielsen a little bit here. I haven't done it on corn, but and I haven't updated of recent, but a number of years ago, 7 or 8, I put together, instead of looking at a national trend on soybeans, I had regionalized soybean production in the United States, and I had 5 or 6 different regions that I used. I then developed a trend yield for the region and each of those regions. And then on an acreage, harvested acreage adjusted basis, I added those together to come up with a quote unquote national trend to try. And I really did that to try to accommodate the movement of soybeans around in the Midwest and the change of the acreage base, because soybeans, like corn, we've moved west and north. I mean, North Dakota has the fourth largest soybean acres of any state in the U.S. I mean, it's huge. And you know, we're doing the same thing in corn. So I sometimes wonder if maybe we shouldn't try to come up with some identifiable regions and look at these yields in each region, come up with appropriate trends. Deteriorates quality of data a little bit, because you know, you're shrinking your data pool a little bit. But it does, I think, give you some kind of a depiction of what's going on with yield as you see the movement of the Corn Belt more west.
We'll close out in just a moment. But, Bob, I do want to ask you one quick question about this planting season. The corn has been in the ground for many people for a couple of weeks. It's just now beginning to emerge for most of them. I'm wondering if that has any impact in your mind on yield over time.
Throughout at least the Eastern Corn Belt, where the temperatures in the past couple of weeks have been certainly below optimum, if not downright injurious to the crop, certainly I think there, eventually we may determine that there are a number of fields that have stand problems with either poor germination or corn leafing out underground or plants that are simply stunted because of these very unusually cool air and soil temperatures that we've had over the past week or so. But you know, that remains to be seen as to what that impact will be. The forecast leading forward certainly is much more favorable in terms of temperatures. So I think anything that gets planted this week forward is certainly going to germinate and emerge much more quickly than what's been put in the ground the previous 2 weeks. So, you know, as usual, it's a waiting game, and you know, we can sit here and maybe hem and haw about what the crop that's already in the ground may look like, but until we actually see it and able to walk it and evaluate it, it's a little hard to say for certain.
Now let's close out with a final word from each of you. Jerry Goodell, any final word on trendline yield?
Well, I think that we've kind of covered some of the issues that have been involved here on how you some of the pitfalls of utilizing certain length of time and look at short-term situations and the impacts of them, things like that. Even as we just talked about now, I just flipped over to this week's numbers on plantings, and yes, Illinois is above average, so is Iowa, well, close to average, definitely Indiana. But then we turn around, South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, none of those states have even got 5% planted from there. You total up the number of acres that are part of the total 92 million we've got out here, you'll come up with quite an interesting total there with Minnesota, South Dakota, and North Dakota is 4 million. The other two were 6 and 9 million, so, or 7 million, I should say. So that's a scenario that part of it. That's the whole impetus to have my discussion and Dale's contributions at the net, the users, was to have the USDA look at these numbers more realistically than utilizing some long-term connection without really putting it in. Now, you remember, they did end up decreasing their national yield estimate last year. I think it was 179.5 or 180. They took it to 178 in June. They didn't take it in May, but I think they took it in June. And that was a good move because the fact we had the issues in the Northern Plains. And I think we've, right now at least, I'm not sure we're going to not get anything planted until late May and June up there like we did last year. But I think in that case, it's definitely a possibility that that 181.5 number could make a big adjustment here going forward. But the problem becomes right now is that the market's reacting to their perceived situations. So, well, maybe the 181 is not right, but there'll still be a 180. And so that still doesn't really reflect what potentially might be the middle of the range of what was really out there at this time. But on a longer-term basis, yes, potential is there for increases, but I'm also more unwilling to point out this issue about the acreages moving into areas that are not as productive as they are from east of I-35 all the way to Columbus, Ohio. That's the golden area of the Corn Belt. And if that yields, I think, are coming up to a point of issues of being able to get a whole lot more out of them Hopefully we do get some, but I think the key feature is trying to get the western parts of the U.S. Corn Belt going better than they are right now, because I guarantee there's people out there forecasting right now there's just going to be another potential drought that's already established in Nebraska and Kansas to stay there all this summer. So we've got lots of things to talk about as we go. But right now, at least, I think the world hopefully has a more jaundiced eye at some of these USDA numbers.
Dale Durkles, your final word?
You know, I think go back to reinforce one of the things I said early, in that, you know, trying to forecast these trend yields is more of an art than it is a science. And some of the things that Professor Nielsen had looked at, you know, really kind of reinforces that. We all look at them a little bit differently. Certainly the kind of trend yield pattern I look at is different. You know, the last 4 years we've had yields end up being below what the USDA's initial forecast was. But I'll go back in the 4 years prior to that, and maybe five, we had the final yields for the corn end up being higher than what USDA's initial yield forecast was. So, you know, maybe we've just gone through a period where weather and other variables has just generally been disappointing, which would say that, you know, the USDA trend yield at 181.5, we may not like it, but it may not necessarily be wrong either. Although, you know, in looking at some of the longer term things like Professor Nielsen's model that goes back to 1956 with a great R square, you know, at 179, I think is probably a little bit more fair starting point.
And Bob Nielsen, your final word.
I'd make two brief comments. One relative to lateness of planting, and you know, I think a reminder to folks that late planting in and of itself is not a kiss of death on corn yields. We've had many, many examples of late planted crops that yield as good or better than the long-term average. So I, for one, never get terribly excited or antsy about late planting, because it's just one of many things that influences yield. And that ties into the second comment, that when we talk about these trend yields, it's always important to remember that trend yield is simply that. It's a trend. It's a prediction of the future, but that future is influenced by many, many, many things, from the day that crop is planted until it gets harvested at the end of the year. So I think if we keep in mind that trend yield is simply a somewhat accurate predictor, maybe, but it's not going to be exactly precise every single year.
You've been listening to Commodity Week. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. You can always hear the whole of our program online anytime you'd like, or as a podcast. Search out Commodity Week or go to willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Bob Nielsen from Purdue University. He's a professor emeritus of agronomy, along with Dale Durkles of Grain Cycles and Jerry Goodell of Midland Research. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.